Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming to this exciting event. It's my great pleasure, Ian Beck, the European Institute, to see you all here. It's an event organised by the European Institute and the School of Public Policy as part of LSE's Brexit programme. It's saddening some of us we have to have a Brexit programme, but this is one of the things that we have to endure. So I'm delighted to welcome France's Europe Minister. She's been beating up the people on the Today programme already this morning, so I'm getting a bit worried about this. Nathalie Loiseau is a long-time career diplomat, but has done many other things in her trajectory, including being in charge of ENA. For those of you who don't know what ENA is, that's where all the top people in France go to be educated. And even President Macron is an ENAC, graduate of this school, although he's in the particular bracket known as l'inspection des finances, which is the top of the top.
It is.
So it tells you something about whether he's an insider or an outsider. Now today what we're going to do is Madame Loiseau is going to speak for 15 or so minutes for the introduction. There will be then time for a little bit of questions and answers directly from me, and then I want to go also to you, so prepare your questions for when we come around. I'll try to take them in groups of three. We are recording this, so when the microphone comes to you, please speak very loudly into it so we can get the recording. That way more people can benefit from hearing what goes on today. So without further ado, I'd like you to welcome Madame Loiseau in a good LSC style, and she will give us her opening remarks. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, dear friends, it's always a pleasure to be back in London, and especially to be here at the London School of Economy, one of the most prestigious higher education institutions in Europe. I'm aware of LSE's commitment to its cooperation with European universities. I also know the work and commitment of LSE's department, faculties, and students on European issues in the months ahead. We are going to need even more of your expertise and participation in the European debate. Maybe, at some point, 3 years ago, expertise and knowledge were not sufficiently associated to the decision-making process. In my previous life as the Dean of ENA, I had organized, early 2017, a conference about knowledge, forecast, and power, savoir, prévoir, pouvoir, to draw lessons from several experiences, including Brexit, where knowledge was not at the center of the conversation. It's also heartening to see that many French students are choosing to study abroad in the UK despite Brexit, and obviously they are applying to the best universities and in particular to do LSE. And in doing so, they try to emulate famous alumni, George Bernanos, Russell, Hayek, or closer to us, French Nobel Prize Thomas Piketty. In fact, it's also the case of a French member of the Parliament for our citizens in the UK, Alexander Holroyd, who is here today with us. Thank you, Alexander. I had a look at LSE's alumni in the current UK Parliament. It's interesting. From prominent Eurosceptics to fervent pro-Europeans from both main political parties, LSE has helped produce a wide range of ideas on the European Union. In France and other EU member states, we have been following closely recent developments in the UK Parliament. One thing seems clear now, 3 weeks before the end of the Article 50 period, time is running out. The clock is definitely ticking. And the ball is in UK's court. We are patiently, graciously, but somewhat nervously waiting for you. You decided to leave the EU. Fair enough. No hard feelings. It's your decision. The way you leave is also your decision. If you want a smooth Brexit, we have the recipe. 585 pages are waiting for you. The withdrawal agreement is the result of 18 months of intense discussions between the UK government and the EU negotiator, with the full, constant, and unwavering support of the 27 member states. This deal is a sensible deal. It protects the peace process in Northern Ireland in the interest of both the UK and the European Union. It provides for an orderly exit, giving certainty to our businesses and our citizens. It's heartening to see that many in the UK Parliament support most of the deal. For example, when it comes to the protection of citizens' rights. The deal is a result of compromises on both sides. The EU did not get everything it wanted. I have no problem acknowledging it. Take the backstop. That would be activated only if there is no agreement on our future relations after the transition period. It provides for a UK-wide customs union so that Northern Ireland remains in the same customs territory. That is not the solution the EU had in mind initially. We changed our plans according to British requests. This deal provides a roadmap for the future. The political declaration is a basis on which discussions on the future can start as quickly as possible. It leaves some options open and many issues remain to be agreed on. The discussion about the future has hardly started, although it's the most interesting part of the negotiation. Still, the debate in the UK is heated and impassionated. Perhaps at last, the proper debate is taking place in the UK about Europe. But to have a proper debate, we need to clarify the facts. I would like to make a few points clear on some of the key issues. For many in the British Parliament, the main issue is the backstop. So there, let me be very clear. The EU does not want the backstop to be implemented. We don't like the backstop. We don't want to use it. We don't want to stay trapped inside the backstop. But we must have a backstop ready if need be. Why is there a backstop? Simply because the UK and the EU want to protect the peace process in Northern Ireland. The backstop makes sure that there will be no hard border between Northern Ireland and Ireland. If it is implemented, we certainly do not want it to be permanent. We couldn't, in fact, make it permanent even if we wanted to. It would be in contradiction with EU treaties. But we don't actually want it, full stop. The backstop is not an ideal solution for the EU-UK relationship. It does not provide full certainty for businesses and citizens. If it is implemented, we will need to move to the future relationship as soon as it can. This is why we can say with certainty that the backstop is necessary in the withdrawal agreement. There cannot be any renegotiation of the letter or the spirit of this key element. On the future relationship, I sometimes hear in the British debate that the lack of clarity on the future is an issue for many people. First, let me say that the political declaration is actually quite detailed on many aspects. Secondly, we are open to including more details in the political declaration if this helps. There has been more and more debate in the UK about an extension of the negotiating period set in Article 50. Last week, the British Prime Minister set out a sequence of events with which might or might not lead to a request for an extension of Article 50. First, let me say that to introduce this request is a decision for the United Kingdom. As far as we are concerned, we do not want nor need an extension. Although we deeply regret the UK leaving the EU, we want this debate to be settled so we can move on discussing our future relationship. As President Macron said a few days ago with Chancellor Merkel, we could accept an extension provided that it would be based on a specific and credible plan to find a solution to the deadlock, and that it would be acceptable by the Chamber. There will be no blind extension. There cannot be an extension in the dark. Well, I'm running out of metaphors, but I think I have my thought. Having said that, we are making intensive preparation for a no deal. Our priority is to get a deal, but the uncertainty is leading us to prepare for every eventuality as responsible governments. A disorderly exit is in neither our or the UK's interest. Work on our preparedness is going well, both at EU and national levels. Let us be frank. If it happens, a no deal will be disruptive. There is no doubt about it. But we have taken and stand ready to take all necessary unilateral steps to minimize the effects of no deal. Now let me tell you something. Brexit is not the sole issue facing Europe. While London is understandably focused on Brexit, the 27 are dealing with a number of other challenges. The next few months and years are going to be both risky and exciting for the EU. So forgive me if I tell you a bit about what the UK is going to miss. The status quo in the EU is not sustainable. Brexit has played a part in showing that there is profound discontent towards the EU. Perhaps we acknowledge this too late. Of course, there are reasons specific to the UK that explain why this country chose to exit the EU. But many in the EU share some of British people's concerns. Brexit is a wake-up call. Given that the EU was becoming more abstract for ordinary citizens and was even sometimes perceived as a threat, we did not demonstrate clearly enough the advantages of being members of the EU in a globalized world. This is why President Macron made proposals to reform the EU when he took office, and again, as recently as Tuesday, in newspapers all over Europe. We are convinced that the only effective way for our countries to raise the big challenges of our time is through cooperation. Be it climate change, terrorism, or migration, we need a coordinated approach. Europe gives us more control, not less, over our destiny in a globalized world. We need, however, to speed up the renewal of the European Union by recapturing the true spirit of Europe: freedom, protection, progress. I'll make only a few points. One of the most urgent tasks is to ensure that we can protect the core of our democracies, the organization of free and fair elections, be it against cyber attacks or manipulations, by deploying quickly experts on the spot when needed. We also should ban the funding of European political parties by foreign powers and banish all incitement to hate and violence from the internet. We are convinced that we need to revisit the relationships between EU member states on defense and security, with a more concrete and active solidarity between us in case of aggression. We proposed to our EU partners a new treaty and a European Security Council, which would also enable us to address those issues with UK. What would be the point of discussing defense and security without the United Kingdom? In the economic field, protecting our continent implies to guarantee fair international competition, to ensure reciprocity, to foster the emergence of major European champions, and to protect our standards, including social and environmental ones. It's also about time that we recover the spirit of progress. What is at stake is the ability to ensure a progressive a strong convergence between EU member states. We propose creating a social shield, to guarantee the same pay in the same workplace and minimum wage adapted to each EU country. Progress means also scaling up our commitments to the climate and health, with ambitious targets such as zero carbon by 2050, pesticides halved by 2025, and implementing new and much needed tools such as a European Climate Bank, a European Food Safety Force, and independent scientific assessment of hazardous substances. We finally have to increase the available means for making the EU a powerhouse for innovation. As you can see, we have an ambitious agenda for Europe. This will provide great opportunities, but also a greater flexibility for member states so that each one could decide on the rhythm on which to go forward without preventing the others to do so. I know that flexibility is something the UK has always been very keen on. And it is a strange paradox that it should leave the EU at this precise moment. A conference for Europe should be held this year to identify the necessary reforms and establish a roadmap. This conference should be prepared with experts, but also citizens' panels. Europe needs to listen more to its citizens. This is why we have organized citizens' consultation on Europe from April to October 2018 in every EU27 country to gather ideas, concerns, and proposals from European citizens. I've been talking about what we would like to do to make the EU better in the near future. Let me now have a few words on our ambition for our bilateral relationship. The UK and France are facing common threats and challenges. These threats and challenges will only continue to grow. We need to address them together. France and the UK are both experiencing waves of populism. Some people in this audience may ask whether the Yellow Vests movement is compatible with our European policy, which I have just described. In fact, this movement provides us with an opportunity. We are engaging with the people through what we call a great national debate all over the country. This debate is also happening in French communities abroad, including here in the UK. Our democracy will be strengthened by this process. Let me be very clear. France is not giving up on the necessary reforms it needs. Quite the contrary. This great debate will give a new impetus to reforms in France and hopefully in the EU. France and the UK are both facing threats to their security. The instability in the Middle East, terrorism, and other major threats are common challenges. France and the UK share a common analysis of these challenges. Whether they concern the situation in the Middle East or in North Africa, cyber attacks or other issues, our interest and our commitment to peace and stability have never been as strong as they are today. In short, come what may, we will maintain and enhance our strong strategic partnership with the UK. British students will still be most welcome in France, and I hope to find as many French students here as you are today in my next visit to London. Thank you.
Merci, madame. I think you exemplified the title of your book, You Want to Choose Everything. Very good read if anyone is not familiar with it. Now, my job at this point is to try to be provocative. So my first
question... Can it be my job too?
My first question to you is there any formula that France would like to see for the future relationship with the UK that is consistent with what you interpret to be the British wishes? For example, in the customs union or not in the customs union, in the single market or not in the single market, allowing free movement?
Well, you mentioned the French-British relationship and at the same time the European Union-British relationship. I think we regret Brexit. We would have preferred the UK to remain in the European Union because we want close relations with the UK. And the closest possible relation is to be a member state. Everything else is less positive. We should not lie about it. There is not a better option than to be member states if you want to be very close partners. But as far as we regret, as much as we regret the decision, we respect it. For 2 years now, approximately half of my time has been devoted to implementing the decision of the British people.
You have my sympathy.
In the smoothest possible way, with little success up to now. You decided to leave, it's up to you to say where you want to go. If you want to remain in a customs union, say it. If you want to remain in the single market, say it. Your choice will be accepted provided that rights and obligations of a future third state, third country, are balanced. The closest the relationship, the more you have to abide by European regulations, that's obvious. If you want to drift away, that's your choice. But of course, your access to the European Union will be more narrow. For us, the best possible option is the closest possible relationship. But we respect what you will tell us the day you will tell us.
Right. According to reports in the British press, I'm being very careful with my wording here, France is seen as the country being most obstructive to getting away from the risks that we see. I'm sure you'll deny this, but how would you respond to this allegation?
There has always been a love-hate relationship between France and the British media.
Je suis écouté.
We are used to it. France has very long been blamed for approximately everything in some of your tabloids. And I must say we take pride in it. And it provides me with
some form of entertainment in the morning when I read it. More seriously, some in this country have bet for 2 years on the divisions of the European Union. And they have lost their bet. The 27 are united, not against the United Kingdom, but in favor of a solution which protects the interest of the European Union. We are your closest partner, not only because of geography, not only because we fought for 100 years and we know each other better than any other country in the world, not only because we are the entry point to people and goods coming from the UK to the European Union, but because there are hundreds of thousands of French citizens living in the UK and hundreds of thousands of British nationals living in the south of France.
Mainly the Dordogne.
Let me turn briefly to France and its European ambitions in two respects. You may know that yesterday we welcomed former Italian Prime Minister Gentiloni here. Mm. And I'm going to ask you exactly the same question I asked him, which is, how damaging is the series of disputes that we've seen between France and Italy for the European project? And who's to blame?
I mean, there is no dispute between the French people and the Italian people. There is a very strong relationship built on history, and we will celebrate the 500th anniversary of Leonardo da Vinci on May the 2nd in Amboise, inviting the President of the Italian Republic to France, which tells quite a lot. And I mean, Leonardo da Vinci is not Italian nor French, he's European. He's a symbol of European Renaissance, and he belongs to all of us. Having said that, the day a political leader comes to your country not to meet your democratic opposition, which I will do later in the day, going to the British Parliament, but decides to meet with someone who is in favor of riots, taking the Élysée Palace by force, and forming a military government. And the guy who decides to meet this interesting fellow is the Vice Prime Minister. You have to react. You have to say this is not something you can do among friends, among partners, and you simply say that it doesn't help, and normally it doesn't help the interest of the Italian people. I think it was very clearly understood by Italian leaders and by the Italian public opinion. But on a daily basis, we cooperate in each and every possible field, including on this radioactive topic of immigration. The day the Italian authorities decided they would close their ports to boats rescuing migrants, we decided that we would welcome some of these migrants in France, and we took the responsibility of organizing the answer of other goodwill countries throughout Europe. We always answered present. We were always there to help Italy, because we know that Italy has faced a huge challenge with the migration issue. So this is my answer. I don't know what Mr. Gentilini's answer was.
I think you're being a bit disingenuous in saying it's just about Di Maio coming to speak to the Gilets Jaunes, because there have been a series of disagreements which seem to me to point to a contest between President Macron and Deputy Prime Minister Salvini, above all, about the direction Europe takes. And if France and Italy divide, that is bad news for Europe.
If you ask whether we have the same political opinion as far-right leaders, Let me remind you that Emmanuel Macron fought against a far-right candidate in the presidential election. So that's obvious. We don't agree on many, many issues. And we will not change our mind just because Mr. Salvini wants to take part into a contest. He's not part two because he's not the Prime Minister of Italy. The interlocutor of President Macron is both President Mattarella and Prime Minister Conte. Up to now, Mr. Salvini did not succeed to become the Prime Minister of Italy. He's the Interior Minister of his country, and he has to focus on what benefits his people. But you're right, there is a challenge and there is a threat and there is a danger facing the European Union. You have nationalist movements, most of them coming from the far right, who want to destroy the European project. They consider that facing the challenges I mentioned earlier, climate change, terrorism, digital revolution, globalization, migration, the best solution is to get back to the past, to close their countries and not to cooperate. There is not one single topic on which far-right leaders throughout the Union agree to cooperate. Ask whether Mrs. Le Pen would be ready to welcome the migrants Mr. Salvini wants to send her. Of course not. Ask Mr. Kaczynski whether he agrees with Mr. Orban on the relationship we have to have with Russia. Naturally not. So they don't have a common project, but they pretend they can lead Europe. Let's see whether the ones who are in government can lead their country.
You might like to use a phrase that I've taken from a former director of LSE, Ralph Dahrendorf, who said, "Populism is simple, democracy is complex."
Right.
Anyway, let's turn now to the audience. And can I remind you to speak loudly into the microphone so we can record it? And if anybody wants to Twitterize about this, there's a hashtag there of LSE Brexit. So let's take a few questions. I'll take three at a time. So start, easiest person is the one next to you. Say who you are, speak loudly.
Thank you. My name is Juliet, I'm a student in the Master of European Education at LSE. You mentioned regarding Brexit, the extension option. I was wondering, given the European elections at the end of May, don't you think that this option is quite limited because the United Kingdom might be very likely to organise elections for the European Parliament in 2 months, and it could have huge effects on the European Parliament's election composition? Yeah, I was wondering about that.
And behind there.
Madame la Ministre, thank you for the presentation. My name is Arthur Corbell, and I'm a student in the Master of Public Administration here at LSE. My question is on the restricting of potential sources of financing for political parties. I heard that some political parties have a hard time getting financing for the EU elections. Some examples include ID, the National and Concept Commission in France. So don't you think that restricting potential sources of financing for those parties can actually also represent a threat to democracy?
And a third question here.
Hi, my name is Cosimo, and I'm a student of EU politics here at the LSE. First of all, I'd like to thank you for the way that you have been standing up to the provocations of the Italian government. As an Italian, so that's quite a lot. The question is concerning what you said about how we should reform the EU. I would like to echo what Mr. Gentiloni said yesterday. He basically mentioned the Schuman Declaration and how pragmatism should be at the core of the way of building and reforming Europe. And in the last few days, we have seen how President Macron has come forward with a very ambitious plan of actually reforming the continent. And I was wondering whether this is actually the right approach, in your opinion, considering also the how it has been received across the EU. You have seen Orban that is actually throwing his weight behind Macron's plan, whereas other European leaders have been more skeptical. So I'd like to have your advice.
Right. If I summarise very quickly, EU elections, including the possibility that Brussels would have to endure more of Nigel Farage, the point about just heard about the Macron manifesto for Europe and whether that is going to be acceptable, and how to finance parties in the EU elections. I'm repeating this for the recording.
Well, let's start with the extension and this thrilling perspective of meeting Nigel Farage again in the European Parliament. Actually, he was the first person I bumped into when I first came to the European Parliament. It was sort of welcome to Strasbourg.
The first one I met was Jean-Marie Le Pen. Well,
we have all. Extension, Brexit, and European election. We don't need an extension. We need a British decision. We have worked for two years, full time for Michel Barnier, half time for people like me. We don't need more time. We need you to make your choice. You prefer Brexit, soft or hard? That's up to you to decide, and up to us to face consequences. And this has to be realized as well. Right now, uncertainty creates anxiety among British citizens, but also among European citizens as well, and especially among businesses, and it's good for no one. So, should there be an extension? Why would we say yes if there is no reason? So let's admit there is a good, credible reason for that. Why not? You mentioned the limit of the date of European elections. It's not up to me to describe the absurd situation in which the British government would be organizing European elections on its territory just before leaving the European Union. Being a member of a government, I wouldn't like to face it and to explain it to my public opinion. But one never knows. I think time has come to take a decision and to give clarity to people on both sides of the channel. The idea of restricting financing of political parties was the second question, and whether it's a threat for democracy. Your question was not absolutely complete, because the option is to restrict financing for political parties coming from countries outside of the European Union. What is a threat for democracy? Restricting this financing, or admitting that Russian banks are financing far-right movements throughout the European Union? What is the biggest threat to your opinion? And why should we accept that foreign banks coming from countries whose behavior has been obviously to fight against the unity of the European Union would be allowed to finance political parties which are as well against progress in the European Union at the next European election? Tell me, where is the threat to democracy? Gentility and pragmatism. Are we pragmatists or are we too ambitious? Well, you know, for 10 years, the European Union has preferred status quo to approximately everything for two reasons. Not to annoy London and not to annoy Warsaw. Let us see the result. You're leaving, and Warsaw is more often than not blocking progress within the European Union. It's about time to be ambitious, because history is not waiting for us. Either we decide to take back control of our destiny at the European level, or others will do it for us. It happened already in history. But the new element we are facing is that our American ally is describing us as foes of the United States, and not only talking about it, but implementing tariffs on the pretext of national security of the United States against European companies. If we don't understand that, if we consider that we can continue with l'Europe des petits pas, which was very popular at some point where other countries were busy elsewhere, we will wake up one morning with China, the United States, Russia, India, designing a world where we don't have a say. Look at the digital economy, for instance. You have three possible choices. The law of the jungle, this is the American model. Complete control by state, this is the Chinese model, and censorship and everything that goes with it. And then you have the European efforts to regulate the digital economy. This was in Europe where we invented digital intimacy with general regulation on protection of data. Nowhere else. And this is in Europe when we are providing creators, authors, publishers with assurances that they will have their share of the value created when it goes to internet. Nowhere else. We are able to invent a new model where the digital era will benefit people. Are we willing to do it? That's the only question.
I can't let you escape part of Cosmo's question, which concerned Orban's endorsement of President Macron's ideas.
I'm jumping with enthusiasm. What he said precisely was that he was happy that we open a debate, meaning that a debate is needed. But it was not only Orban. Let us be clear, it was the Prime Minister of Portugal, it was the Prime Minister of Belgium, it was the members of SPD in Germany, it was the Prime Minister of Finland, and I will not list them all because it could become boring. Of course, you have loud voices in Europe, louder than others. Speaking loud doesn't mean you're a strong man. It just says that you have a strong voice. But many, many in the European Union were waiting for some sort of leadership in Europe because we are facing challenges, because Brexit is asking us a number of questions about our destiny, our choices. And we wanted to start the debate, not imposing ideas to others, but trying to see jointly where we want to go.
Okay, let's take another round of questions. We have plenty of demand. Woman first. And then Richard over here. Passing the ball.
Me? Yes, okay. Thank you. I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask about Brexit again and the extension of the issue.
Just tell us who you are.
That's my life, don't worry.
My name is Anna and I'm an alumni at the IR department.
International Relations.
Yes. So you're sending me a UK decision, but it's very likely that next week the decision will be to request an extension. And in that case, would France prefer a shorter one or a longer one, as, again, has been suggested in the press, that France is the one pushing for a longer extension? And perhaps you could give an example of a valid reason for the extension, for instance, like a referendum, or which you think is a valid reason.
And give it over your left shoulder.
Hi, my name is Victoria, and I'm a student at the Master of Public Administration. My question is more about the future of Europe. You mentioned the grand debate in France and as well as citizen consultations as part of defining the European project. And I was wondering whether there were other proposals on the table to increase participation and representation of citizens in the European institutions.
Okay.
Richard Bronk, who's a fellow of the European Institute. I was wanting to ask about your comments towards the end about flexibility in the development of Europe from here on. And I wonder if it might help, that even at this late stage, in providing a Brexit solution, maybe in the transition period. As you know, there's a very entrenched cultural divide now between the open and younger Britain of cities and the more rural, small-town Britain. And popular opinion, as well as politicians, are extremely divided between Remain and No Deal. And in terms of trying to find a compromise solution, one that is out there is this Common Market 2.0 or Norway Plus or EFTA or whatever you want to call it. The obvious political problem for those trying to make that suggestion in Britain is that it makes you a rule taker. So is there a possibility of having the re-examining this idea of an outer ring of EU membership that is basically full membership of the single market and not much else? And could that be a possible solution that helps to solve the need for the backstop and gives Britain and maybe one or two other countries a comfortable place on the outer edges within the European Union?
Okay, if I try to summarise very briefly, if there were to be a request for an extension, short or long, and what for? You partly answered it already. Second, in the spirit of the Grand Débat in France, can there be a different mechanism for a citizen's voice to be heard in Europe? And to go back to the Jean Pisani-Ferry and company suggestion of inner and outer circles of European integration, is that feasible?
All right, so do you prefer your extension short or long? It's up to you to come to a decision. I'm sorry I'm repeating this time and again, but I read a press release earlier today saying that a government source in London was waiting for a European decision. And so, once again, it's your turn. We are not asking for an extension. There has to be a reason for an extension, because if it's more of this lovely moment where we don't know where we are and we don't know where we're going to be, sincerely, I would prefer it to stop as soon as possible. So first, there has to be a reason. What is a credible extension? One that meets the intention of the British Parliament. It has to be supported by a majority, because until now, majorities in the British Parliament told us what MPs don't want, but hardly told us what the MPs want. So that would be some sort of progress. And it has to address the priorities and the consistency of the European Union. Our priorities, what is at stake for us? Directives for the mandate of Michel Barnier are not hidden in our pockets. They are published on the internet. It's the first time in history that a negotiating mandate is published on the internet. So you know everything about what is at stake from our side. So up to you to choose. And I'm not here to say that you have to do a second referendum or general election or choose a customs union. This is your choice. My personal preferences are of no interest, because it's not me who is going to choose. It's you. On the future of Europe, this importance that we are putting on citizens' consultation, what we are doing right now with the national debate, which is really a thrilling moment to complement representative democracy. I'm here monitored by a member of the National Assembly and a member of the Senate, so they are looking closely at me, and I have to say that representative democracy is of the essence. Having said that, we are in the 21st century, and citizens want to express their views in between two general elections, and we have to address that. First of all, there are parliamentary elections in the European Union next May. European elections have the smallest turnout in the EU, and that's a pity, because it's the best possible occasion to say what you want regarding the future of Europe, provided that political parties campaign on Europe and not on something else. But this is a golden opportunity. But more than that, there are new tools which citizens are beginning to use within the European Union. There is a European Citizens Initiative which is possible. You need to gather signatures for a petition, and at some point, if you gather 1 million signatures, which is pretty easy within the European Union, Commission, Council and Parliament have to take it into consideration. It has already been used, and now we are discussing things like the end of electric fishing in European waters, and it will be decided because citizens had started a campaign against electrical fishing. So that's one of the examples of things on which in the Council there were resistance, in the Commission there was no interest, and in the European Parliament there was divide, until citizens came to the doors of the institution and said, come on, electrical fishing is killing the resource. This is pure madness and you have to stop. And all of a sudden, members of the Council and members of the European Parliament said, we have always thought that, and we will decide for a total ban of electrical fishing. So that's one of the ways in which we can include more citizens. Right now in France, in our national debate, in the coming weeks, we will organize citizens' panels with people selected at random who will look at proposals made within local debates and tell us what they think about it. This is new. This will complement what members of our parliament are doing on a daily basis, and we'll see what goes out of it. But I think it can be interesting. Flexibility. To which extent are we flexible to have you back with the cake, eating it, and still wondering what's the menu? No, I'm kidding. I think, well, already the European Union is quite flexible. You're not in Schengen, you're not in the Eurozone. So tell me about two-speed Europe. This is my daily life. And it works quite well. Look at permanent cooperation on defense. We decided to launch it, and people told us, well, you're going to be 4 or 5 usual suspects in the European Union interested in defense, and others would look at you and show no interest. We are 25 member states. This means success. But 2 others decided not to join, and that's fine with us. We have the same process with the European prosecutor. It started by 9 member states saying we should have a European prosecutor able to address cases of corruption and misuse of European funds. It started slowly with only a handful of member states showing interest. Now there are 22. And now we are selecting the European prosecutor. But the ones who are not interested will not be forced to join. What is not negotiable is that if you want to be in the single market, it comes with the 4 freedoms of the single market. Otherwise, this is not the single market. Means people, goods, capital, services have to circulate freely throughout the Union. And I know that this, at one point, was your difficulty. But now I also know how precious European citizens are for the economy, for the benefit of the United Kingdom. And speaking here at LSE, I know that you all believe what I'm saying. So being against freedom of circulation for people might not be in the interest of any of the member states.
We've reached our time now. Do you allow one last couple of questions?
Sure.
Right, I had Bastien, you were...
Right, I can.
I didn't write one into it.
Oh, right. We're behind you again.
Hi, my name is Gabe. I'm a student in the Political Economy of Europe program. So my question is a bit more about the Franco-British relationship. Because as you said we have a love and hate relationship, and Brexit definitely put a lot of strain on it, also because it showed how interlinked and intertwined our geographical economic interests are. And this is a particular situation for the Franco-British relationship, which is not the same for, say, Italy or Germany, who definitely don't have the same interests as the country. And so I guess my question is, how will this impact the agenda that France will bring in the European institutions and the future negotiation on the relationship between the EU and the UK?
Okay, one last question. This time it has to be a woman.
Hello, my name is Nina, I'm from the European Institute as well. So, as Michael said, it has a very ambitious plan. Just wondering whether we have the means to meet those ambitions. I'm particularly talking about innovation, for example. So, the EU is planning to spend 20 billion, for example, on AI in the next decade, when China is going to spend 150 billion on it. So, that's only one example of on whether the EU has the ambition to meet what Macron is proposing on the rest of Europe.
I won't even bother repeating, just because it's loud.
So, first of all, let me correct what you said on relation between France and the UK. It's not a love and hate relationship between France and the UK. It's more about the relationship between France and the British media, which is love and hate. Well, little love and a lot of other things. What are we going to do in the future? Will it be important that we have this special relationship, all these partnerships between France and the UK, when we negotiate the future of the relationship with the European Union? Sure. This morning I was at the first summit of mayors, French and British mayors and local authorities. There are more than 1,000 twinnings between our two countries, and we still consider it's not enough. We are more than many, many other member states interested in the strongest possible relationship with the United Kingdom in the future. And I would stress, especially in terms of defense, because there are two countries in Europe which can send troops for difficult missions. This is France and the United Kingdom. No other. When we decided to bomb chemical plants in Syria, you had the United States, France, and the United Kingdom, able and willing to face the challenge, and no other. This is one of the reasons why, in his piece published in The Guardian, President Macron mentioned the idea of the European Security Council, which might include the United Kingdom, even if you leave the European Union, meaning that when we take serious decisions on foreign policy, defense, security, the decisions have to be taken by the European Union, and we have to keep our autonomy in decision-making processes. But it's good that we talk with the United Kingdom when our common security, our common destiny is at stake. Otherwise, we are losing everything we had for decades. I'm not certain this is consensual within the European Union, but this is something we are ready to push because we are pragmatic. You sort of read the op-ed as being maybe too ambitious and not sufficiently pragmatic, and I would strongly deny it. This is out of pragmatism, because there are needs, because we know what we are facing, that we are making proposals. We don't want to consider that status quo in the European Union is just fine. This would be ideology, to say that everything that we have done until now is fine and perfect and we should just keep it as it is. This would be contrary to what we are living on the ground on a daily basis. Part of my time is devoted to touring France and meeting with farmers, business leaders, workers, unionists, NGOs, ordinary citizens, to try to have a sense of what they need to get from the European Union. And everything that is included in our positions, ambitions, proposals, comes from this observations, discussions that we are having. Nothing out of Euro-federalism, for instance. Sometimes we are portrayed as federalists. We just inaugurated 2 days ago a European College of Intelligence Services. We did not decide to create a European FBI or a European CIA. We decided that our intelligence services should work even more together and should be trained partially together. This has nothing to do with federalism, but it has a lot to do with what is at stake right now here in Europe. And as I know that you will leave the European Union, I also know that you will remain in Europe, and we will do our best efforts so that everything that relates us will be even stronger in the future.
I think that's a very optimistic, positive note on which to finish. So will you join me in thanking Madame